It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there was a lot of excitement about the return of hemp as a cash crop in Wisconsin. But some farmers who tried growing it last year ran into problems, especially when it came to weather. We'll talk to a hemp industry expert coming up. First, when couples are married, they have a choice to make about names. For a lot of people, the default choice for a marriage between a man and a woman is for the wife to take the husband's name. But that's not the only name game in town. Sometimes both partners keep their names, sometimes hyphens get into the picture. And there's been some reporting that people are trying another approach, coming up with a whole new last name. It could be a combo of both their names, could be something completely new. Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also director of research at the Council on Contemporary Families and the author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, how common is this, as you're seeing it, Stephanie, that people don't just take one name of one spouse or the other, they don't hyphenate, whatever, they come up with a whole new last name?
Well, I don't think it's common enough for us to, you know, have it on the radar as, you know, some major trend. Mm-hmm. But what we saw is we saw a real uptick in women keeping their own names or doing hyphenated names in the 90s. And I think in the 80s and 90s, as 70s, 80s and early 90s, as we came out of a period in which women lost their identity completely. And by the way, we should go back to the history of this,
sure,
because that was not traditional in the 1950s, the way a woman was referred to and referred to herself as Mrs. John so-and-so, you know, not even keeping her, identifying herself by her first name, kind of burying herself. And so women, and of course, women were buried in their husband's existence legally as well, because he owned community property and stuff. So there was a period where women were pretty militant about keeping their own name or coming up with something else. That dropped off again in the 90s, in the early 2000s, I think because of some of the difficulties, you know, when picking kids up at school and, you know, whose name do you use, this sort of thing. But I think that as the age of marriage continues to rise, that in addition to the question of, you know, is this a male dominant custom, it's just not practical anymore for a woman to lose the name that she's made maybe 30, 35 years of her life. She's lived under, she's written things or produced things or held jobs down in. So people are trying to come up with creative ways to solve that.
Let's take this back even further than you just did, Stephanie. In the evolution of the concept of last names, we haven't always used them in many cultures. We used to just be Rob, and maybe as Rob, the one from Madison or something like that. Why did we start using surnames, and why did women start having to use the man's surname?
Well, it goes back and forth in very complex, interesting ways. In the Roman citizen, you start in early Rome. People had a given name and then a clan name, and there could be thousands of people in a clan. And so later during the Republic, people began to have family names to differentiate themselves. But this was only for Roman citizens. And in the Germanic and Celtic and Persian traditions, what you're talking about, you had a first name. And then if you needed to differentiate yourself from somebody else, you did it by that occupation or their living place. You know, John the Baker, Edward the Smith, Dan Glover, Danny the glove maker, Margaret the Thatcher, or Christopher Hill, you know, who lives on the hill. Sometimes there were also nicknames like, you know, Edward Short to indicate that he was short, or maybe sarcastically that he was tall. It was the Normans, when they conquered England, who brought these laws of couverture that a woman's existence was totally subsumed in her husband's. And they're the ones who introduced surnames in England. And they spread very, very slowly. In England, they didn't take root in Scotland or Wales till much later. In countries, I mean, in areas that had these strong female controls, women tended to take their husband's name because the inheritance went through her woman's earnings, property, and legal existence were subsumed under her husband. On the other hand, we should remember that this was a very hierarchical society, and hierarchy often outweighed rank hierarchy often outweighed gender. So in 14th century London and other medieval cities, Male apprentices often took the surnames of their masters, and upper-class women were often exempted from these gender hierarchies. The word Mr. Larson, whatever, means master, right? And Mrs. originally stood for mistress, someone who governs. It had nothing to do until the 18th century with a woman's marital status. A woman who was unmarried businesswoman could call herself Mrs. And in Sweden, incidentally, the word husband, which meant master, was applied in legal documents to women who were property owners as well as men who were property owners. So it's a really complex thing. And in many areas, people took the last name of their land holdings, you know, so that Eleanor, Duchess of Aquitaine, Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, when they married, she didn't take his name or vice versa. So there have been a lot of variations in this in history. And in Spanish, in Spain today, somebody like Picasso, we know him by his maternal name because you take the paternal name first and then the maternal name. And so the maternal name is sometimes what we know some of these famous Spaniards under. Although, of course, her mother got his name from her father. So it's not like the egalitarian form that some feminists would like to see in the naming practices.
We're talking about last names with Stephanie Kuntz from the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and the latest trends in whether people take their spouse's name, make up a new name. You can join in with your thoughts and experiences at 800-642-1234. Stephanie, you mentioned in the 70s, 80s, maybe a little bit in the 90s, there was a backlash for many people against that default position where a woman takes husband's last name. What talk about some of the reasons that led to that.
Well, it was based on it wasn't some sort of symbolic feminist, you know, making a fuss about nothing. It was because right up until the end of the 1960s, women were literally subsumed under their husbands. A woman in 1974, as late as 1974 in New York, I remember reading a case where a woman whose husband was in an insane asylum and who wanted to rent an apartment to be close to him had to go to the mental institution and have him sign the lease. Women couldn't take out credit cards in their own name. They, in the states that had community property, the man could dispose of his share, but the woman could not dispose of hers. So this was, you know, we weren't completely covered as back in the 18th and 19th century when a woman married everything she earned or brought with her at marriage belonged to her husband. But you still had this notion that is legally called coverture, that your legal existence was subsumed in many ways in your husband's. And women didn't like that for some odd reason.
I want to throw in another twist now with modern marriage. Now we have same-sex marriage legalized. What are we seeing? How are same-sex couples resolving the what's our last name issue?
Well, I haven't really studied that. I don't know of anybody who has actually gone through and quantified that. But among the people that I know or work with or whose work I follow, I know that many of them keep their own last names, and others have been doing this kind of hyphenated. And a few have been doing what you talked about at the beginning of the program, actually coming up with a new name that they think represents both of their individual histories or interests. And that can be, I imagine, quite a fun little project to come up with something like that.
We're talking to Stephanie Kuntz right now, professor of family studies at the Evergreen State College, author of Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. She's with us to talk about the names we use after we get married and whether one or both spouses go through a name change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this? Maybe not even a trend yet, but it's happening. There's some reports on it. Couples opting to totally change their last names to something new. Is this something that you or your partner did? Did you consider it? What questions did you go through before figuring out the question of what name to take? Or was there a question? Did you just know what you're going to do all the way through? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Stephanie Kuntz, professor of family studies at the Evergreen State College in Washington and author of the book Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. She was with us to talk about a growing trend of families taking on new last names instead of taking men's surnames when they marry and start families, just the general questions about what name to take after marriage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you do this? Did you choose a new last name? What drove that decision? How did you resolve the decision of whose name to take, what name to take? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Jill is with us in Madison. Jill, hi. Jill, are you there?
I am. Hello. Hi. Good afternoon.
Yeah, what do you want to tell us about, Jill?
I just thought this conversation was just interesting. I didn't realize how many people put that much thought into it, but then I started to realize that me and my husband actually did that same thing. When we were engaged in thinking about it, he had actually been adopted by his stepdad, and they are no longer in a relationship. So when we were talking about our last name, we thought, how great would it be to take his grandparents' name, so to get back to his mother's maiden name and carry on that tradition, because he had such a wonderful relationship with his grandparents. So that is the route we took. So we both changed our name.
Interesting, Jill. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Stephanie, that's an interesting choice. I don't know how common that is, though.
I've heard it a few times. I don't think it's going to, you know, it hasn't gotten to the top of the charts. It's funny because I wanted to mention to you, you know, people say, oh, it's so confusing to have these extra names and stuff. But in Spain, I mentioned that, you know, people inherit not only the surname of their father and their mother, but all the ones from all of their the relatives. So that, for example, the former premier, Jose Luis Rodriguez Zapatero. Now, Rodriguez was his paternal surname, Zapatero was his maternal surname, but he could also have been and was in some cases referred to as Jose Luis Rodriguez Zapatero Garcia Valero Garcia Asensio. So if you think it gets confusing for us, then the Spain has managed to survive for centuries with that kind of complex naming system.
Thanks a lot for that call. Go now to Valerie with us in Rice Lake. Valerie, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what did you do, Valerie?
Well, when we got married, I took my maiden name and made it my middle name and totally wiped out my given maiden middle name.
Valerie, do you ever miss the middle name?
No.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that. So taking her given last name, bumping it up to the middle name, Stephanie.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, of course, we do have this tradition that women are named either after their fathers or after their husbands. And so we do lose the maternal line in ways that, for example, in Iceland, they don't necessarily do. So that's a problem. And there's no easy way to do it, except perhaps by coming up with an invented new name. But then you lose both sides. So, you know, I think that it's important that people think about this only as a symptom of how we want to negotiate new relations in a world that is changing, but it's not a make or break decision for your relationship. I can guarantee you that.
Valerie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Stephanie, is this something where this idea of we have a choice in our name, it's an individual decision that says something about us as a couple, as individuals, is that kind of different than it used to be where it was maybe more of a family issue?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, in general, we have developed a lot more tolerance and acceptance of people's individuality. You know, 50, 60 years ago, parents wanted their kids to follow in their footsteps or go a little further, but they were very, very concerned with teaching them, you know, the family traditions. Now, parents say, I don't care what you are. You know, I want you just to be happy. I want you to do something worthwhile. And we do that in our parent-child relationships, and we do it in our relationships with each other. And the big, dance that we are trying to do, something that nobody in history, I think, has ever tried to do before. So when you get discouraged, it's important to bear in mind that this is a grand new experiment. We are trying, I think, in our romantic relationships, in our marriages, to combine a real commitment to putting the other person's needs right up there alongside your own, but also to preserving one's own individuality. And that takes a lot of thought and a lot more negotiation than back just only 50 years ago, when it was just expected that the wife would subordinate her individuality to that of her husband, and her husband could take that for granted. So we're doing really interesting things in family life, and I don't think that they're bad things, but they are challenging things. How do we honor that individuality, but don't turn it into kind of selfish individualism?
We're talking to Stephanie Kuntz from the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, talking about marriage and names, the decision of whose name to take, who changes a name, if anyone, when a couple gets together, gets married. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and maybe the decision you made. Do you think we should stick with what used to be the full-on default? Woman takes husband's name, at least in a marriage between a man and a woman, or should it be more of a choice? Which way did you go? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Anne joins us now in Two Rivers. Anne, hello.
Hi. When my husband and I got married in the early 80s, we had a lot of discussion about which last name to take, and my husband asked if I would take his last name, and I said, well, would you consider taking my last name? And he said, well, no. And I said, then, well, my answer is, well, no, I won't take your net last name. And we settled on a combined name, which was Henner, which was a nice, easy name to spell. And we tried it out before we got married. The church we belonged to only knew us as Henner. And then in the end, when we actually got to the marriage ceremony, my husband is the only male in the family, and he panicked and backed out and said, no, I want to keep my own name. So I ended up keeping my own name, too.
And thanks a lot for sharing that story, Stephanie. I mean, it's symbolic, the names, but it's important to our identity. But that really points toward what you were just saying, that it's a negotiated process, not an assumption that one party is going to give up on this one right away.
Absolutely. It is a negotiated process. And it has to be, as men and women have different backgrounds. I, for example, when I got married, I had already published things under my own name. My husband had not. We kept our own names. But, you know, now he gets occasionally referred to as Mr. Kuntz, and that's not his real last name. So, you know, fortunately, he has a very strong ego. It doesn't make him feel threatened. But these are, you know, these are the sorts of things we have to deal with now that we're taking for granted, most of us, that this should be an egalitarian thing, not a one-sided decision.
Anne, thanks for sharing your story. We've got Peter with us now in Baraboo. Peter, hello.
Hello. My father came up with an idea about how to mitigate the loss of all the female names, is that you'd hold on to your own name, and so there would be different names for the husband and the wife. But if they had a boy, that boy would take the wife's name, and if there was a girl born, that they would take the husband's name.
Okay, so cross genders there, but either way, the name might go on, Stephanie. Again, I'm sure there's probably not a lot of numbers on that, but some people are trying to come up with creative solutions here.
It's wonderful to hear some of the solutions and some of the discussions. And as I say, there's no magic answer. I mean, if you want the magic solution, you need to share the housework and the childcare. that's going to be a pretty good predictor of a good marriage. What you decide about your name is not. But the fact that you're having these discussions and thinking about it and talking about it so openly, that's a pretty good sign, I think.
Peter, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. I think Charles is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Charles, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, we got married back in 78, and we had a lot of discussion about this. My wife suggested that we both take a hyphenated last name, and I kind of rejected that idea because I thought it's kind of unsustainable. I mean, if we have a son with or a daughter with a hyphenated last name and marry somebody else with a hyphenated last name, I mean, where do you go with that, right?
Charles, thanks for the call. And Stephanie, I guess that would just take us to the Spanish outcome that you talked about earlier.
Exactly.
Charles, thanks a lot for the call. Stephanie, we've talked to you a lot about how marriage has changed over the years, not just names, but what you were just talking about with housework and chores and things like that. What are you watching for, symbolic or practical, when it comes to the way American marriages are developing today?
Well, I think that we are moving, that individuals are doing a lot better than our government and our employers are, that we really have got to the point where studies show that the happiest, most successful marriages are the ones where the men and women share, not divide down the middle like 50-50, but really think through and talk through what are their individual desires to do in the house and don't just assign them by gender stereotypes. By the way, this is something we can learn from same-sex couples, that they tend to talk that through a lot more because there's not obvious, oh, well, you're obviously going to do that because you're the girl and I'm the boy. So people are talking these things through, and we keep running up against the fact that there are so many stereotypes and so little accommodation for real sharing. For example, we don't have, we're the only country in the world that, advanced country in the world that doesn't have maternity leave, but there are many countries like us that don't have paternity leave, and you're not going to get equality until men get access back to family life, just as women get access into work life.
Stephanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Stephanie Kuntz, professor of family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's the author of the book Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. She joins us today to talk about couples and how they choose their last names. If one takes the other one, if they make up a new one, lots of solutions. Keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about some of the challenges Wisconsin farmers saw trying to grow and sell industrial hemp last year. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new study finds that by the end of the century, fish die-offs in Wisconsin's lakes could be 4 times more common than they are now. We'll talk about those predictions and how higher temperatures are already causing problems for fish here in the state. First, last year was a big year for industrial hemp with a pilot program that let farmers grow the crop in Wisconsin. Under the 2018 Farm Bill, it was legalized across the country. A lot of people had high hopes for the crop in the state, but for farmers who tried growing it last year, there were a lot of challenges. Ken Anderson is the founder and president of Legacy Hemp, a company that works to get hemp markets off the ground nationwide. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
What kind of issues did we see here in Wisconsin for the farmers in this pilot project trying to grow commercial hemp?
You must be talking about last year, the catastrophe. The issue that we had last year, and it wasn't just hemp that had this problem, but was the amount of rainfall, and not the lack of rainfall, but untimely, very heavy rainfall was the biggest issue for especially grain production in Wisconsin. And for our market, our growers were under contract for food grade production. And that amount of rainfall and the time of the rainfall not only affected yields, but the quality of the grain itself. So, and it looks like at least to the start of the year, we had, it looked like pretty much the same pattern, but now the forecasts are looking a little bit better for us. But the conditions were not right for really many fields and many crops last year in Wisconsin. And I hope that this isn't a trend that continues in the area.
You mentioned food grade hemp, Ken. Can you tease out for us the different kinds of hemp that farmers might be trying to grow around the country and the different uses for it?
You know, I think right now, everyone, when they hear the word hemp, they're thinking of CBD production, because that's kind of the latest craze for sure. And there's definitely efficacy in CBD use. So that is a very fast growing market. So that's one of them, CBD production. But I want you to kind of think of that as horticulture production. It's a lot different growing style than you would for either grain or fiber, which is the markets that my company is involved in. Grain, right now the grain is used mainly in food products. The secondary markets for the grain are going to be your industrial oils, and that really is kind of it for the grain. It is a very fast-growing sector and large sector. And the fiber market, which historically in Wisconsin and in this area is really where what hemp was grown for. In fact, Wisconsin had the longest running and the last running hemp mill in the United States. It was in Ripon, Wisconsin. The Renz Hemp Mill was the last running hemp mill, and it was actually operational until 1957 in Wisconsin. So those are really the markets. You're going to have fiber, which is kind of up and coming, been left behind. Grain is a strong market, and then right now the hottest market is CBD, but a totally different production method.
WPR talked to Levon Felton, a farmer near Viroqua who tried growing hemp last year. He told our reporter he wasn't able to sell any of it. He thinks he lost about $20,000. Here's a listen.
At least if we have a corn crop that doesn't go well, or beans, we're going to get something. You know, we're going to be able to recoup some of our costs. You know, basically with this, if you lose it, you lose it all.
And Ken, with those other crops, sometimes you can still sell them as animal feed, even if they're not ready for human consumption. Of course, with other crops, we have crop insurance. Are there unique risks to trying to grow hemp for human consumption?
Absolutely. And it's based upon the crop being banned for so long in the United States. We don't enjoy the kind of cushion or the safety nets that other crops would have. Especially, you know, crop insurance is coming online right now, but it's mainly for hail insurance, not total coverage crop insurance. And also, he is spot on without having secondary markets. That's really where it is a high risk. And Levon actually was contracted with us. And everyone knew under these contracts that it was food grade only. And fortunately, we are sending out some disaster relief payments, which we're not, you know, contractually obligated to do. So he is receiving something, but it was definitely bad for many, many growers in Wisconsin because not being able to make food grade. And I want to put out there that our other, contracted growers that grew other crops that were trying to make food grade, those crops also didn't make food grade. So it wasn't necessarily just specific to hemp not making food grade in there. But Levon is definitely right that with those other markets you have, with those other crops, you have secondary markets. And the secondary market for hemp grain last year wasn't as big as it is now. It is something that we do have secondary markets for producers that can't make food grade this year. But it just wasn't there last year. And this is an industry that I think most of these guys that are on kind of the spearheading this industry, they were really risk takers, and they knew, you know, it was outlined that this is a risky crop because we do not have the cushion that's provided by the government and insurance. And we also, the secondary market was very small last year. So these are things that as the industry grows and develops, you know, these are going to come in a lot more, a lot. It will become treated just like another ag crop.
Talking to Ken Anderson from Legacy Hemp, looking at hemp production here in Wisconsin. A rough opening year last year for a pilot program in Wisconsin, thanks in large part to the weather. Ken, was this bad weather year for food grade hemp a one-off, or does it raise concerns that, hey, maybe Wisconsin isn't the place to grow food grade hemp?
You know, I think it is a one-off. I don't want to poo-poo the idea of growing, grain for food in Wisconsin. I just was touring the southern plains of Canada, And our crops this year in this region look so much better than the ones that are in southern Canada. So I don't think I would advise, just because up there their issue is drought. I mean, they have crops that were planted May 30th, where we have crops that were planted May 30th. The average, the median height is about 5 feet tall, and their crops are just coming out of the ground. They're about 6 inches tall. So I don't think I would go up to Canada and tell all those guys that have been growing hemp for, you know, 15 years that they probably shouldn't grow hemp because it's not going to be viable. I think that this was a one-off. I do agree, though, that genetics right now are going to play the role that when the fiber market does take off, I think that Wisconsin will be a strong fiber producer. That's not saying that they can't produce food-grade crops or food-grade grain. It's just that in this region, you know, there's a reason that fiber was the strong point for the Wisconsin hemp industry in the past. And I think that fiber market will be a very strong market in Wisconsin. But I do believe wholeheartedly, especially with in the conventional crops right now, you can't use any type of fungicide or anything that you could use on, you know, you can use fungicides on other food grade crops and in other crops. You can't use that in hemp, where that would be, you know, that's kind of like another insurance policy that you would have. So 2 years in Kentucky, we had very bad yields, and my farmers down there were saying that, you know, this, I can't believe this is like the worst 2 years we've had in 100 years. And then the first year was, I hope we don't see that again. Well, then the third year, it was bumper crop. So it's really, you know, you're still, as a farmer, farmers know whether I can add water, I can't take it away. I can't add sunshine unless I'm under lights. So it is a risky business, but without the fallback that other crops are granted through different programs, hemp is still a risky crop to grow in, and producers need to be aware of that. And, you know, we hope for the best. And if it were not going to work to be a food grade crop in Wisconsin, that's something that I don't believe in, but we cannot base that off of 1 year data. You just cannot do that.
In our last minute or so, Ken, do you see farmers going all in on hemp production, or are they just adding this to the variety of crops they're growing?
You know, I wouldn't want any farmer to do 100% hemp. I wouldn't want them to do monocrop hemp like we see some of the other crops in the United States. I think that it's a good crop to grow into, to put into your rotation. I also think that you have to, especially if you're dealing with CBD, you know, most large scale farmers aren't going to want to do what has to be done to have a CBD crop, because it is grown completely different. It is a horticulture crop. But I think that grain and fiber is a great rotational crop for farmers in the area. And these markets just need to develop, and we need to get these protections in place.
We'll leave it there for now. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for your time, and good luck, and God bless all you farmers.
That's Ken Anderson, founder and president of Legacy Hemp. He was with us today to talk about some of the challenges farmers saw with the first season of commercial hemp growing in Wisconsin last year. You can learn more about this at WPR.org/news. We've got some reporting with more comments from farmers who tried growing hemp last year. And if it's you we're talking about, love to hear from you as well. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know how it went for you last year, how it's going for you so far this year. Coming up, we'll talk to a researcher about what rising temperatures could mean for Wisconsin's fish and what to do about it, some new research and some projections for the future along the way. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a special piece from Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about a Wisconsinite whose mission is to preserve traditional Indian folk music. First, new research highlights the threat that Wisconsin's favorite fish species face from rising lake temperatures. A new study published in the journal Nature Climate Change found that by the end of the century, large-scale fish die-offs in the state's lakes could become 4 times more common than they are now, especially in the southern half of the state, and researchers say we're already feeling those impacts. Sam Fay is an assistant professor of biology at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and a former honorary fellow at UW-Madison. He was the lead researcher on this research project. Sam, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
A lot of times when people talk about climate change, they're talking about future impacts and projections out decades ahead, and that's part of what you do. But also in the study, you look at what might already be happening with climate change when it comes to fish here in Wisconsin. What are we already seeing?
Yeah, so that's a great point. What we're seeing so far is that based off of some historical data going back a few decades, we see that there's a really strong connection between when large fish die-offs happen in the summertime and what the environmental conditions are like in those lakes. And specifically, we see that there's more fish die-offs occurring when in lakes that are categorically warmer and for lakes that are having a particularly warm year and for lakes that have had a reasonably short ice duration. So we know that there's already this relationship between what the lake environment looks like and when these summertime large fish die-offs occur.
We'll get into the impacts, direct and indirect, of heat in just a few moments, but can you give us a sense of the kind of fish we're talking about to help bring it home for people?
Yeah, absolutely. So I should just say that the data that we've used in this study are data that were collected by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and they have been responding to citizen reports of when a large fish die-off occurs. Importantly, they can't be at all lakes at once, so they rely heavily on getting a phone call from local people to report on something that's happened in their backyard. And really, one of the things that jumps out immediately from this data set is it is basically a complete list of all of the freshwater species that we see. So these large fish die-offs really encompass basically every fish species that you can see, from some of the traditional cool and cold water species, such as walleye and perch and cisco and trout, to a lot of the more common warm water species, the bass, the bluegill, pumpkin seeds, etc.
And when we say a fish die-off, what does this look like? How many fish might, or what percentage, I guess, of fish might we be talking about in a lake?
Yeah, so there's some variation ranging from the upper end hundreds of thousands of individual fish to a lower cutoff, I believe, of about 25 fish per 10 meters of shoreline. So I think it's one of the things where you kind of know it when you see it, when you go out and you see that there's been something very unusual that have happened in an area, and it just isn't the, oh, I found one dead fish here or there.
Now, when you started going through this data and figuring out how temperature related to these die-offs, were you surprised at all?
Yeah, we actually were. So going into this project, we really thought we were going to see an overall decline in the amount of fish die-offs that occurred. And the kind of working model that we were working off of was just the idea that winters, which are responsible for a lot of fish die-offs, have been getting less severe throughout the past few decades. And so we really thought we were going to see an overall decline in the amount of die-offs that occurred each year as a result of winters not being as severe, maybe the ice thickness not being as thick as it normally is, or the temperatures not quite getting as cold as they have in the past. But we actually found was the opposite of that, which is that the biggest trend in these data have been an increase between the amount of summertime fish die-offs that have happened, and it seems like that is a function of lakes starting to get warmer in the summertime.
Talking to Sam Fay from Reed College in Portland, Oregon, talking about fish die-offs in Wisconsin lakes and the relationship to a changing climate. Sam, let's get to what exactly is happening here. First of all, do warmer temperatures in and of themselves contribute to fish die-offs?
So the data sets that we have suggest that there's a kind of a direct link between when periods of extreme temperature occur and the occurrence of these summertime fish die-offs. So mechanistically, that doesn't say exactly what is causing the fish die-offs. We just know that it's related to these periods of high temperature. So you could imagine that taking place in a few different ways. It could be that these are temperatures that are warm enough that they are just lethal for these different fish species. And we know that you know, many of the temperatures we have started to see are above the physiological limits for certain cold and cool water species. It could also be that there is a relationship between an increase in the surface temperatures of lakes and the amount of available habitat that fish have. So that for deeper lakes, there's always a cold water reservoir for fish to use deep down, but many times fish feel a squeeze between the hot temperatures at the top of a lake and the cold but very oxygen-poor environments at the bottom of a lake. So it really creates a limit of what habitat is usable. And then finally, it could be that the increases in temperature could be impacting something to do with the food web in which these fish are embedded. So perhaps they're having some detrimental impact on their food resources, which are then contributing to the die-offs that we see.
And I think a lot of us have seen this, at least anecdotally, temperatures warm up. Maybe after a rain and more runoff, we see more algae blooms or cyanobacteria blooms. Is there an indirect cause there? The heat leads to more of this stuff in the water, and that affects the fish.
It can be. So we didn't look at that specifically, but the harmful algal blooms did show up as a cause of many of the events that we looked at. And you know, that is something that has a clear link between the conditions in a lake and the occurrence of these events. Because I am an optimist by nature, it also suggests that there are perhaps factors not related to temperature that, you know, is a really changing at this global level that individuals and communities can deal with at the regional level to try to minimize the occurrence of these fish kills. And one important management strategy can just be to limit the nutrient inputs into lakes at a watershed scale. And you could imagine that having fewer harmful algal blooms, which would perhaps feed back and minimize the chance of there being more summertime fish die-offs.
So the DNR and a county government can't single-handedly turn back climate change, but they can manage maybe some of these secondary effects, as you say, by trying to keep extra nutrients out of their waterways.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there's many things that can be done at a watershed or even a lake level. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has also been doing some innovative work to try to create extra habitat structure and extra shade by felling trees into the nearshore regions of lakes to provide that kind of perhaps an extra buffer from the heat.
Now, we've been talking about the data you looked at over what's happened so far. Another part of your report projects out into the future. What kind of scenarios could you see if we don't have efforts to remedy this?
Yeah, so because of this clear historic link between temperature and the occurrence of these large die-offs, we predict that the amount of summertime fish die-offs will double by the mid-century and will quadruple by the end of the century if air temperatures continue to warm as is expected.
Does that level of die-offs, does that affect the possible survival of a species in the state? Do we start to see numbers where it's no longer a sustainable population?
Well, it's definitely worrying. You know, Wisconsin is the third most popular destination for anglers to visit in the United States. You know, it has a $2.3 estimated billion-dollar industry for sport fishing, and so it seems like it is worrying to have these kinds of outcomes. And you could imagine these types of events really being the catalyst to reduce the number of fish that are occurring in lakes, or perhaps to usher in some kind of change in which fish species are present. So, for instance, a trend in north temperate lakes have been to start to see a transition from cool and cold water species such as walleye towards species like bass.
Sam, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Sam Fay is an assistant professor of biology at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, formerly a visiting scholar at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about his study that found large-scale fish die-offs in Wisconsin lakes could quadruple by the end of the century because of rising temperatures and climate change. If you live near one of our thousands of lakes, or if you're a regular angler yourself, you can let us know what you're seeing out there. Do lakes and fish populations in your part of the state seem healthy? at your favorite fishing hole? Have you noticed any changes over the years? Have you witnessed, maybe even reported, one of these fish die-offs yourself? Do studies like the one we've been talking about concern you? Send us an email. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us. That's @CentralTimeWPR. If you're like me, you might be thinking about getting more exercise this time of year. If you're unlike me, you may actually be getting more exercise. A bunch of my coworkers here at WPR seem to go out running fairly often. I know some of them are working up to a marathon of some sort. More power to them. Here's some research that could help them and you if you're into this sort of thing. You can talk yourself into a better athletic performance, but it may depend on how you talk to yourself. As reported on the website Medical Express, sports psychologists say self-talk, giving yourself encouraging messages, can help you do better. But according to research published in the Journal of Sports Sciences, you're better off talking to yourself as if you were someone else. So instead of saying to yourself, I got this, I can do this, try saying to yourself, you got this, you can do this. Scientists in England tried this out with a group of bicyclists. In a small study, the lead researcher said, quote, second-person self-talk generated significantly greater power output and faster time trial performance than first-person self-talk. So saying you to yourself instead of I to yourself, you go faster and stronger. And he goes on, they were able to do more work but didn't notice any difference in their workload. Maybe I'll try this on air. You can do this, ID Rob. This is Central Time.